Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, extremely good show, I think, Bob, because we've got, I think as you alluded to in the billboard, I mean, it's like you dig a hole, you get your hose, but we got everything else you need to know in terms of growing absolutely anything today.
But you really don't know a whole lot about what's going on with the dirt, what the dirt needs, how the dirt got there.
I think some would take offense to it being called dirt, in fact.
Oh, soil.
Soil.
Sorry. Sorry, you dirt.
Dirt gets under your nails.
Dirt offended.
Plants grow in soil.
Do I ever?
Yeah. Greg Schwab, University of Kentucky. Testing the soil, but beyond just testing the soil, why is it important to test the soil, and what does the soil, in fact, provide for our plants?
And I talked to Greg setting up the show, of course, and he's got some really interesting, revealing information that's going to surprise a lot of people about testing the home garden.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to give it away, but...
stay tuned, folks.
Yeah.
That's not a tease. I don't know what it is.
No, it's informational.
Yeah.
And revealing, as
yes,
I said.
I'm very excited about learning more, to be sure. So that's coming up. And then also Barbara Damrosch, Four Seasons Farm in Harborside, Maine. She is a columnist, a weekly columnist with the Washington Post. The Cook's Garden, I believe, is the name of her column. She's also the author of The Garden Primer. It was written in 1988.
That's back.
And it's back, and it's 100% organic now. She always had those tendencies anyway,
right.
But it's 100% organic now. It's the second edition. They're sort of celebrating the 20th anniversary of the book. But it's sort of like the joy of cooking kind of book. Do you know what I mean?
Well, no.
But well, yeah, that's true, because you don't cook. But it's like what you have shelf.
Yeah.
That whenever you have any questions, you can pull it down and take a look.
It might even be a little better than the Federici Almanac. I'm not sure. A little thicker. But yes, 818 pages.
Yeah.
And one problem with this kind of book is often that when you try and say too much, you don't say enough about anything. But I think she doesn't fall into that trap. I think there's a lot in here for anybody at any level.
It's well organized,
You
know, so that certainly helps. But everything from annuals to perennials, fruits, vegetables, your lawn, you know, so everything's categorized in terms of what, you know, may appeal or be consternating you on any given gardening day. So we're looking forward to talking to Barbara. You know, she's one of those names, too, that's been around for a long time and associated with sustainable agriculture, that sort of thing. And it may be in the language now, people think it's sort of new, but these are things that folks like Barbara and her husband, Elliot Coleman, have been working on, you know, for 20, 30 years, you know, trying to get a little bit more mainstream. So we'll talk with her about that as well.
Yep, it'll be fun.
All right, Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Well, a couple things. One, this is the season. We always talk about the petty old leaf borer because it drives me nuts, frankly.
Yeah.
I've got about six huge sugar maples above my pond, and this time of year, this leaf borer cuts off the maple leaves, and they come floating down into my pond every year.
And they're teeny tiny leaves, too. They're not even like,
And people get alarmed because my maple tree is dying. My maple tree is dying. It's not.
Yeah.
It's just that stupid borer, and you can't do anything about it, and it doesn't kill the tree. Maybe even does some good. It thins it out. But
yeah, maybe.
That's what you're looking at, folks.
That's right.
And the other one is, for the 19th year in a row, I'm making a vow to put some supports up for my tree peonies because I have this incredible flush of heavy, pink, wonderful flowers. Come the thunderstorm, bam, they went over. It didn't break the limbs.
Yeah.
But I've got to find...
And they haven't kind of popped back up?
Not yet, because they're just so big and so thick and so fat. That's the good news. So I got to figure out some way to support my peonies, and
our tree peonies hold up pretty well on their own. The herbaceous peonies flop, but we use those little rings.
That's what I want to do.
Yeah.
So I'm leading kind of around the wings or something, or I'll go out there and hold them up for 3 weeks myself because they're so great.
That when you're a humongous bloom, sometimes it's a challenge just standing upright, huh?
So it's a little more angst for the spring gardener, but I'll get over it. How about your place? What's up?
I got no angst, I can say.
The girl's got no angst.
I want to tell you about my nesting boxes that I actually built.
Oh, wow.
And I'll, you can kind of make fun of it because they're not professional at all. They're not wobbly, they're sturdy. They look a little cattywampus.
Well,
and you can just go to our website and check out my homemade nesting boxes.
What are they nesting?
They're for my hens.
Oh, your chickens.
And as soon as I put it up, because I put it up and attached it, you know, to the wall before I put the roof on top of it.
Yeah.
And they all, like, ran to it and jumped in, the little box. It was just so funny. They loved it.
The sound of a dozen hens laughing at you?
They loved it. So, okay. I made it all from scrap materials,
okay.
Not scrappy bad materials, no. Just scrap materials that were in the barn. I made it all by myself, and you can sort of tell, but the hens like it, and I'm pretty proud of myself, so check it out.
I'm carpenter impaired badly, so
I am too.
I couldn't have done worse than you,
yeah,
I know. But if you're getting eggs, the hens are happy.
Exactly. They were happy with laying it in those plastic, you know, boxes that I had rigged up for him, so.
Nothing else matters.
So this is a little bit more professional looking, if you will, but a little wobbly too, so. I followed the directions in terms of recommended nesting box construction.
I gotta come see your your hens.
All right. Well, I got some eggs for you upstairs. So
I know.
You can enjoy them that way.
So what's going on off the Wishy Estate?
Off the Wishy Estate, there are garden tours coming up, and we wanted to remind you one more time of the 2008 Garden Tour Passport. The passport allows you to get into three different garden tours: Crescent Hill Garden Tour, which is Saturday and Sunday, June 7th and 8th; the Audubon Park Garden Tour, which is June 21st; and then the Old Louisville Hidden Treasures Garden Tour, which is July 12th and 13th. And basically, Bob, you get the whole passport for $25.
Mm-hmm.
But the deadline's June 1st. And you can pick them up at Buttons, Economy Aquatic Gardens, The Plant Kingdom, St. Matthew's Feed and Seed, Thieneman's Herbs and Perennials, or Wallach Nursery and Garden Center. So you basically get three of them for $25 instead of the $32 that would have cost you to go to all of them separately.
And you never have to take off your shoes either.
No.
You can get in line here and
there you go.
Get on board and keep your shoes on. It's a great program.
All right, what else is going on?
This is another great program. I wasn't aware of this, and I should have been. ECOR, which is a nonprofit division of the Youth Build Louisville, has openings for its Summer Conservation Corps intern program.
It's a paid
summer internship. They get $1,000, an eight-week program, open to high school and college students 17 to 20, and they'll work on trail construction, outdoor classrooms, landscaping, community gardens, rain barrel construction,
excellent,
and tree maintenance.
Huh.
Isn't that neat?
Yeah, and what's the deadline?
Yeah, orientation is June 3rd to 6th, so you can't apply too soon here.
Yeah.
And just go to our website at wfpl.org. We'll have information on how you can join this program. And
sounds pretty cool.
A really healthy relationship with the soil, and you get paid for it and learn a lot.
Yeah, no kidding. That might be worth a little follow-up discussion.
Yeah, well.
See what the youth of our community are actually learning, right?
Yeah.
All right, and one more event. Country Corner Greenhouse out there in Shepherdsville on Highway 44. They're going to have a free perennial seminar May 24th at 1 p.m. presented by me.
All right.
So we'll talk about all different types of cool perennials. To be sure, sun and shade and drought tolerant and native and non-native and all kinds of cool stuff.
You going to bring along your chickens?
Maybe some extra eggs.
Okay.
Maybe some extra eggs.
Some of them hard shell, yellow yolked.
Yeah. They're
wishy
good.
Wishy eggs.
But I do know one thing for sure, Bob. My chickens are indeed improving my soil.
And don't we all need that?
We do.
We all need that, chickens or no chickens. And we've got the guy here to talk about that today. He's Greg Schwab. He's a soil extension specialist with the University of Kentucky. Been with the school for 8 years, and he's covered a lot of ground in the process, he says, but he's going to tell us what's in the soil, how it got there, and what we can do to make it better or not do to make it better. Greg, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you.
Now, we talked earlier, you're a native of Southwest Ohio. You've traveled the country quite a bit. Now you've got your roots set at UK, so to speak. How about some background on how you got to what you're doing and why soil?
Yeah, it's a kind of a long story, but basically I started out at Berea College, south of Lexington. I got my bachelor's degree in agriculture, and then proceeded on down to Auburn, Alabama, where I got my master's in agronomy,
mm-hmm.
and then went out to Kansas State and actually took a full-time job running the state soil testing lab, and
wow,
while I was there, had the opportunity to work on my PhD. And that's where I really developed my love for, you know, soil science and extension.
So what was your PhD?
It was in agronomy as well.
Okay. And specifically addressing soil?
Plant nutrient requirements.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so that's what we want to know about today, so we've got the right guy.
You're a hopeful soil addict, it sounds like. Well, let's begin with just the very basics. Where did the soil that's in Kentucky and southern Indiana, where did it come from? How was it created on this earth?
Yeah, it's a pretty diverse group of soils that we have here in Kentucky. A lot of people think naturally that most of our soils come from limestone because that's what we see underlying most of the soils in the state, especially in central and western Kentucky. But we also have a lot of windblown soil, and so that soil is called loess. And so a lot of times what we'll see is limestone-derived soil with loess on top of it. Hmm. And that windblown soil can really come from anywhere, and it's deposited pretty irregularly. So if you think about snow drifts and things like that and how they form on the landscape, you can kind of imagine how windblown soil would also be deposited.
Mm-hmm. Well, Greg, is there any way to determine how far windblown soil can actually blow?
Yeah, so we're talking about long ago in geological
history. Sure.
And so, you know, the predominant wind is from our southwest, and so most of that soil has blown in, you know, from the southwest. Of course, everybody thinks about the Dust Bowl and things like that, windblown soil. But really, we're talking about much, much longer ago than that, that most of our soils have arrived here.
Is it like hundreds of millions of years or
right,
10 million?
Exactly.
Wow. Is it still going on, the process?
Slowly, hopefully, though, that with modern agricultural techniques, hopefully we're not losing nearly as much soil as what we once lost.
Well, that sort of addresses this whole sort of sustainable agriculture movement that we're seeing now, where the point is to sort of continue to build up the soil
right,
as you work it, as opposed to doing things that cause erosion or take away, which many conventional agricultural practices and large-scale agricultural practices do. So, you know, as home gardeners, what's a good way for us to maintain and build up good, healthy soil as opposed to break down
right,
our soils?
Well, there's one question that you should answer really or ask before you even start trying to have a home garden, and that's really to do a really good job at trying to figure out where the most appropriate spot is for your garden.
Mm-hmm.
So in urban settings, a lot of times what we're dealing with is really not natural soil at all. So we're dealing with what the developer left behind. And so a lot of times people start out in really a negative situation where it would be worse than the normal native soil because they don't have a lot of topsoil left. The topsoil that is there sometimes can be compacted and things like that. And so one of the things that I encourage homeowners to do is borrow a soil probe and go around their house and probe the sites that they're thinking about placing their garden. And what you're really looking for is good dark color, dark brown color. And if you see a lot of real bright red colors, that's going to tell you that likely what you're dealing with is some subsoil rather than good topsoil.
Mm-hmm.
And so try to locate your garden where it's nice and dark brown. And then always try to maintain that organic matter. And so things like tillage, frequent tillage, breaks down the organic matter quicker. So anything that you can do to prevent you from having to go in and till it constantly through the summer months is going to be beneficial. So using mulch to control weeds, things like that, are going to be really beneficial for your garden.
Okay, Greg, let's talk about the relationship between plants and soil. What's going on there? What are the roots getting from the soil that they need to nourish themselves?
Yeah, so plants get all of their nutrients that they need from the soil. In addition, then they also get water, and probably just as important as nutrients and water is oxygen supply to the roots. So if you don't have all three of those, then you're not going to have very good performing plants.
Right.
I talked to you earlier off the air, and you said something that I've been thinking about ever since. The average homeowner goes in and get their yard tested, and you said most of the time there's already more than they need. They've already been overloaded with stuff. Talk about that.
Right. So in the soil testing lab, after you've identified a spot, a location for your garden, then the next thing you're going to want to do is soil test. And even if you've been gardening in the same location for many years, you'll still want to invest in a soil test. And almost always, if it's been a historic garden, then likely we'll see that the phosphorus and potassium levels in that garden are probably higher than what they need to be. And that's simply because it's such a small scale. So it's very easy to over-fertilize garden areas. And often gardeners have the attitude, well, if a little is good, then more is better.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually you can run into some problems that way.
Is that detrimental to the plants?
It can be, especially if we're talking about nitrogen. So nitrogen stimulates vegetative growth. And so vegetative growth is good for things like lettuce and leafy greens, but is not so good for things like tomatoes, where you're actually interested in harvesting fruit. And so a lot of people will complain that their tomatoes don't really produce as well as they used to, and oftentimes that can be associated with too much nitrogen being applied.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's also talk about this relationship that plants have with the pH of the soil. So often we recommend soil tests, you know, for plants that are a little bit more sensitive to pH.
Right.
Can you address the whole issue of going back to the, you know, plenty of nitrogen, phosphorus, or potassium is available in the soil, but we understand that if the pH isn't the right pH for that particular plant, it can't get to those nutrients. So can you talk a little bit about the logistics of
right.
it being right in front of you, but you can't take it in?
Right. So the chemistry of the soil is dominated by pH. And so just because we might have a lot of phosphorus in the soil, it may not be in a form that's available to the plant because of the pH. And pH is really just simply how acid or how basic the soil is. And so in terms of phosphorus, the availability of phosphorus is greatest when the pH is around 6.2.
Mm-hmm. How do you adjust the pH then?
Okay, so if you have too much acidity in your soil, then you would add limestone. And if the pH is too high, then you would need to add, usually what we add is elemental sulfur or aluminum sulfate. Both of those will lower the pH, but one word of caution is a lot of times when you start trying to do drastic modifications of pH, it's pretty hard. It's mm-hmm. easy to overshoot your target.
So generally speaking then, for the home gardener, and as you said, you know, especially if you're gardening in the same spot, you know, perennial beds are going to be in the same spot. Most people have their vegetable gardens in the same spot, you know, every year.
Right.
What's our best option for maintaining good soil fertility?
Right. The best option that home gardeners have is definitely adding good composted materials to that garden. Those can be purchased at most lawn and garden companies. What I would look for are materials that are composted to the point where you can't identify the material.
Yeah, it doesn't smell like anything.
yeah, it's kind of hard to find sometimes, but you want something that's really well broken down, and then you want to mix that into the soil every spring. Uh-huh. And then I also recommend that gardeners plant some crop that's going to grow at least a little bit through the wintertime. And so that helps to add, you know, roots and organic matter, so a cover crop. I like to use things that I can eat, like greens.
Okay.
You know, they grow pretty late into the fall, and then you can put some greens out early in the spring. Try to keep that soil pretty well covered all the way through the year and having something actively growing to mm-hmm. add roots and organic matter back into the soil.
Mm-hmm. And then, Greg, people listening to this show, how would they get their soil tested? Go through the local extension agent in their counties?
Yeah, that's the easiest way to do it. Just stop by the extension office. And they usually have soil probes to loan out. They have an information sheet on the best way to collect the sample. And they'll give you a box or a bag to put that sample in and take it back to the county office. And about 2 weeks later, you'll get a recommendation.
But they don't come out and plant and water and weed, do they?
No, unfortunately not.
Okay, man. Well, thank you very much. Excellent information, and I'm sure help some people get out there and get their soil tested.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Greg Schwab is a soil extension specialist with the University of Kentucky. For more information on Greg or how to get your soil tested, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, Barbara Damrosch celebrates 20 years of the Garden Primer, now in its second edition. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And as promised, a great show for you today. We're going to continue to talk about gardening, vegetable gardening, fruit, lawns, everything. But this time around with Barbara Damrosch. She is the author of The Garden Primer, now celebrating its 20th year with a new organic second edition. Barbara also writes a weekly column, The Cook's Garden, for the Washington Post, and runs her own farm along with her husband, Four Seasons Farm in Harborside, Maine.
Other than that, she's virtually unemployed.
Yeah. I'm sure she stays very, very busy. Right. And talking to folks like us, right, Barbara? Welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much,
Sure. Listen, you've been around... And I don't mean like, oh, you've been around for a really long time, but you have been around for a really long time, and in a good way. How did you get so thoroughly immersed in the garden and on the farm over the course of the last 30 years or so?
Well, I mean, I guess it goes way back to growing up, you know, in a family that liked to garden.
Yeah.
And I kind of wandered down other roads. I was actually a college English teacher for a while. But I always really wanted to grow my own food. And in the 70s, I left the city and was raising my son in the country and doing that and sort of wandered into the nursery business. I was actually doing a lot of writing and thought that would be a good extra job. And I really, really loved gardening.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have actually had a farm back then if I'd had the money to buy land.
Sure.
So a long while later, fast forward to 1991, I'd been doing landscape design and some TV for quite a while, you know, all about gardening, writing books about gardening. And I came up to meet the late Helen Nearing, who, with her husband Scott, wrote Living the Good Life, mm-hmm. which was kind of the manual of the Back to the Landers in the 70s.
Sure.
And Elliot Coleman, a fellow author whose work I knew and vice versa, was tying up her tomato plants. And I kind of never left.
And you fell in love.
Yeah. So,
for those of you who don't know, Elliot Coleman is Barbara's husband. And we'll talk about him a little bit later. And you can tell Elliot that for Christmas a couple of years ago, my husband gave me one of the broad forks that he designed.
Oh, don't you love the broad fork?
We do love the broad fork. But Elliot's the one who designed that. In fact, people have heard me talk about my broad fork and how valuable it is in our garden. But we'll get to that in a little bit. You talked about kind of the late 1970s. I think about the late 1970s and the Back to the Land sort of movement sort of being revisited, certainly different incarnation, but sort of being revisited in similar ways now.
Yes, you know, it's interesting you should say that. I've been talking about the same thing. We're getting a lot of young people really, really interested in gardening, either as, you know, home gardeners with maybe their first home or college students who want to have a farm on campus. You know, it's not quite the same back to the land, total immersion in the rural life that we were all after back then. You know, they're not totally abandoning their techie world of iPods and Blackberries and computers and things like that, but they are really interested in kind of reality as opposed to virtual reality.
Yeah.
They like to get their hands in the soil. They like to cook. They like to sew and knit. Sort of interesting, really.
Yeah, I think this time, Barbara, the threat is more genuine. Global warming is real. It's
right.
Here.
And
the 70s was kind of...
People of all ages are saying that.
Yeah, it's here.
And food prices and gas prices and all these other things kind of reflected in that as well.
Right.
Well, your book's been referred to as kind of the joy of gardening for, or joy of cooking for gardeners. Can you talk about the layout and how you approached laying out a book with eight?
Sure. I mean, it's really funny because 20 years ago, 22 years ago when I started writing it, I just wanted to write this little book that would introduce people to gardening and make it very non-threatening, not use any words that I didn't really explain to them,
mm-hmm.
and above all, give them a kind of courage about gardening. A lot of people I found who were beginners were afraid that they were going to kill an innocent plant or, you know, that they'd have a black thumb.
Right.
And I just wanted to reassure people that plants really want to grow, that nature has a wonderful system out there that you don't have to set up. You just have to latch onto it
and
understand it and go with its flow.
Yeah.
So I was just, you know, and my own personal approach to gardening is kind of low-tech and very back to basics, lots of use of compost, you know, things like that, not buying a lot of products, not getting a lot of fancy equipment. And so I wanted to write a book that was really a kind of Dick and Jane primer of how to garden. I didn't know if it was going to be almost 700 pages before I was done. If I'd known, I probably would never have started it.
Yeah.
And then 20 years later, I thought, well, I just need to update this a little bit
right.
because, you know, a lot had changed. There were a lot of new varieties on the market. I wanted to make sure it was all organic. It was almost all organic before.
Mm-hmm.
But, it, you know, once again, it grew, and now it's 820 pages. And so I just added a lot of plants that I now feel, wow, I can't not tell them about that plant.
Right.
You know, took out some plants that were considered invasive that we weren't as conscious of 20 mm-hmm. years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Some new tools. The broad fork, for example, is
yeah.
in there. It wasn't in the original one. And just, you know, a little even more about wildlife and beneficial bugs and trying to sort of keep the whole ecosystem in mind. I mean, I've always written about that, but I think there's even more in the new edition.
An emphasis on sort of the symbiotic relationship of between it all, huh?
Exactly.
So, Barbara, it has... I mean, our philosophies change over the years, obviously. It's unavoidable, I think, if you're a thinking person.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something that you can pinpoint in terms of your gardening philosophy that has, in fact, changed over the years and that you can say, yes, 25 years ago, I didn't consider this at all, and now this is something that's extremely important?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, I used to sort of do a lot of things that were overkill. You know, minimize the section on double digging because I used to think you really had to reverse the soil layers mm-hmm. and just pulverize everything down 2 feet. And, you know, it was the harder you worked, the better it would turn out. And I don't really believe that now. I'm much more observant about the way nature creates fertile soil and fertilizes from the top down. I mean, if you look out there, all that's happening is that leaves are falling from the trees, plants are dying, creatures are dying. Other creatures are helping them to decompose. Earthworms and other burrowers are pulling them down into the soil. And it's all happening in a nice, slow, measured way from the top down. So I try to imitate that, and I try to know a lot about what goes on underneath the soil. I know much more now than I used to about the civilizations of creatures under the soil, many of them invisible, you know, the billions of soil microbes down there that make it all possible. So I'm very, very careful of that life in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, garden soil isn't a thing. It's a process. It's a whole drama. It's a history book. It's a universe down there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm very careful not to walk on it, apply anything that any harsh chemical that would impact it. And I think I also trust nature more. You know, I really trust the fact that if you grow very healthy plants, if you give them everything they need, if it's the right plant for the right spot, they're really going to want to grow, and you shouldn't go around expecting disasters. If something does go wrong, you just say, okay, what could I have done better with that plant? Not what can I go out and buy and apply to this plant that will, you know, repel what ate it. You know, you say, well, why did it eat it? You know, why was it stressed in the first place?
Right. Yeah.
So that's a little different, I would say. I just have more confidence, and I think part of that is just years of doing it. I think most gardeners who've been doing it a long time just have a little more trusting view of nature.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and speaking of years of doing it, tell us about your Four Seasons Farm. It's this Genesis and what it was
okay.
like.
Okay, it's actually called Four Season Farm. There's no F
okay.
at the end.
Sorry.
Of, and I only say that because the website is fourseasonfarm.com,
okay.
and so you have to spell it without the S. FourSeasonFarm.com. And Elliot started the farm way back in 68 when he bought it from Helen and Scott Nearing, and it's gone through a lot of changes. It was just a retail farm stand back then. He went off and did farms for other people for a while, and then he came back in 90 with the goal of starting it up again as a wholesale operation. And then when I arrived a year later, we started on that goal together. And so now we have a farm with a lot of greenhouses, almost entirely unheated. And what our little trick is growing winter greens and fresh dug root crops so that we actually sell fresh vegetables wholesale 12 months
each
of the year.
Season of the year.
Wow.
We also have a retail farm stand and a lot of young workers who come in and help, especially in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, there's quite a lot going on here.
Mm-hmm.
He also does a lot of tool development, trying to do mechanized tools that for the in-between population of people who aren't home gardeners, but they're not big industrial farmers either. They want low-cost mechanized tools. So that's another special aspect of our farm.
So how big is your farm and where is it located?
Well, it's located on Cape Rozier, which is in the town of Brooksville, and it's about two-thirds of the way up the main coast. And it's even though we have 40 acres, a lot of that's wooded, and about 15 acres are cleared, but we only farm an acre and a half, which
wow.
You would think that's very, very tiny, but we gross $120,000 worth of produce off it. So It's very intensively planted. And by making the soil about 10% organic matter, we're able to get much, much, much more produce off a small space than most farms. Mm-hmm. And so it's a kind of model for people who don't have much land or, for one reason or another, don't want to till so much land.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's attracting a lot of interest because I think we're all going to be faced with that task.
Right. Is the public welcome at your farm?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We don't make appointments. We can't guarantee to be here or show you around, but people are always welcome to come up and take a look anytime.
Mm-hmm. So Barbara, what is your system in terms of meeting those sustainable agricultural needs, building up the soil, not taking it away?
We make our own compost out of wastes from the farm, spent crops, weeds, anything like that. We've been buying in manure recently. We haven't always used manure, but it is very, very useful. It's very traditional on a small farm. We are going to be getting some livestock just for home use.
I was wondering about
that. And that will sort of complete the picture and make it more self-contained.
Mm-hmm.
We use crab waste, whatever local things, seedweed that washes up on the road, anything we can find to make compost. And so making compost is a very high priority activity around here.
Is there anything you've tried that just didn't work?
I can't grow okra for beans. The summers are very cool here, and it's simply a plant that needs heat. But then, of course, I've only tried it as a home crop in my own little vegetable garden. I'm positive that if I planted it in a greenhouse, I could grow okra. But Elliot doesn't, like a lot of Yankees, doesn't understand okra. My family, half of my family is from northern Louisiana, so I do.
Oh, and you need to try to grow okra again then.
it has not risen to the top of the list.
Because Elliot doesn't know what he's missing if he hasn't had small okra freshly picked from his own plant, sautéed in a little olive oil.
I know.
It's not sticky or gummy.
I did make fried okra for him once, and it was from the supermarket. He did admit that it wasn't bad done that way.
Right. It's not as bad as he thought.
Definitely not.
Now, you and Janita mentioned some tools he's created. Talk about some more of the things he's done like that.
Okay, well, for home gardeners, he invented a hoe called the collineal hoe and another one called the wire weeder, which are sort of like surgical instruments. They're just these little slivers of metal that you skim the surface of to kind of zap weeds before they even have a chance to grow, which is a very time-saving way of keeping down weeds. He's done these wonderful tools for small farmers. Like, we have this little thing called the tilther, and the reason it's not called a tiller is most people think of a tiller as this big thing, big noisy, smelly thing that
chews up
your earthworm, pulverizes your soil. This is something that has little tiny tiller tines that only go a couple of inches deep, and we use it in the greenhouse to just incorporate compost or whatever into the top few inches of the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does is not bring up weed seeds from below.
Okay.
That's the big plus. Plus, it's very, relatively inexpensive, easy to handle, far less polluting than a rototiller is, and far less cumbersome. And it's the power driven by a cordless drill, the one you already have in your shop.
Oh,
cool.
And you just stick it in there.
Wow.
And even I can use it, and I'm a real klutz with machinery. They're just wonderful little genius things like that he comes up with.
Yeah.
I'm curious, you've been organically adding to the soil for 40 years. Has productivity increased every year? Does it level off at some point and just become easier to grow things?
That's a good question. I think that the areas that Elliot originally started with are still the most fertile on the farm. But it doesn't take more than a few years to get pretty good growing soil. Now, you know, we're generalizing here, but you have to realize our soil is far worse than what most people contend with.
Right.
The pH was 4.3 when he got here, and it's just a very thin, sandy, you know, infertile soil in its virgin state. And nobody in his right mind would farm here. And I once asked him, you know, would it, if you were, you know, with hindsight, would you have come here? Was it worth being next to Helen and Scott Nearing and learning all you learned from them? And he said, yes, it was, because it's rare to find something like that. But you can actually create a soil anywhere. You just have to really work at it. And I think the challenges that he faced here, the long, cold winter, the soil, has made him a better farmer. He didn't take any of this for granted, you know. And he came up with systems that were based on this adversity. He probably wouldn't have had the intense cultivation, you know, the incredibly productive beds, if he'd had 8 or 10 acres of gorgeous fields and all he had to do was take his tractor out there and plant them.
Yeah. So, Barbara, clearly both of you all are pretty serious gardeners.
yeah.
Understatement, perhaps. What's your all's marriage like
in
terms
wow,
of balancing?
We married all's... each other late in life.
Yeah. Right?
We are so lucky to have found each other. I mean, we're really like two kids playing in the dirt.
Mm-hmm. Do you complement each other in terms of your gardening styles and, like, the areas of expertise or the things that really get you going?
Definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, I've always liked growing my own food, but he's a master at food gardening.
Mm-hmm.
And I've gotten better at it by gardening with him, I'm sure. He never knew a whole lot about flower gardening. I mean, he knew how to grow annuals, but he didn't know anything about perennials. I mean, he still doesn't know that much, and he really leaves that much to, part of it to me.
Mm-hmm.
So the home vegetable gardens and the cut flower operation over at the farm, we do sell flower bunches at the stand in summer. That's all my department.
Mm-hmm.
But we definitely overlap in food growing, and actually have a home food garden that I pretty much do myself, just to have varieties that, for one reason or another, we aren't growing at the farm, like the okra was an attempt in that direction.
Right.
You know? Or like if I want speckled lettuce and he doesn't want to sell speckled lettuce, I grow my own speckled lettuce.
Yeah.
And I'm also the farm cook. We feed our crew and often visitors so that there's a big meal. It's like a party every day at noon. The main meal of the day, and we all, you know, get together and talk about the farm, and It's a very
wonderful.
Important part of the day, really, and I'm in charge of doing the harvesting and cooking for that.
Uh-huh.
Does he do windows?
Neither of us do windows.
Yeah. That's a job that never gets done, right? Well, you know, just to sort of round it all out, your passion for sustainable, we mentioned it earlier, your passion for sustainable agriculture is not a new idea for you nor for Elliot. You've long been recognized as proponents of it. Now that more people are recognizing the value of sustainable practices, do you anticipate a serious shift in people's attitudes?
Well, it's already happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, organic is almost mainstream, not in terms of numbers, but in people's perception of it.
Uh-huh.
Most people would rather have organic vegetables or do it organically. I don't find anybody coming to me and saying, could you teach me how to grow with chemicals?
Yeah.
It doesn't happen. They say, how can I do this in a safer, simpler way?
Yeah, and it's like what you were talking about before, the epiphany that you've had over the years is that sometimes, you know, just improving the soil, the least amount of interference on our part sometimes is really the best approach after all.
Very often that's true.
Yeah. So what should people do to help the process along in terms of, you know, sustainable practices, whether they're interested in a little garden in the backyard or not?
Well, they should not use any poisons of any kind, and they should make compost, and they should maybe start small but pay close attention to the soil, because the soil is everything. And then just try some easy crops. If they want to grow a food garden, you know, they'd start with maybe some zucchinis, some tomatoes, maybe some beans, basil, lettuce, maybe some carrots.
Don't do the okra, right?
Well,
until
hey,
you know
if you're in Kentucky,
sure.
Go for it.
Yeah.
Okra's not hard at all.
It's not in Kentucky,
You
no.
just have to say y'all after you say okra.
That's right.
Okra, y'all.
Oh.
Y'all's climate's great for that.
It is.
Jealous.
and the garden primer, the primer, certainly.
I have okra in it, by the way.
Yes, and you should. but that's the thing. It runs from the beginning to the end in terms of getting started.
Yeah, it's stuff on planning your
big,
landscape
small.
And a whole big sort of plant science chapter called What Plants Need.
Uh-huh.
You know, talks about the soil, the water, everything. And then there's chapters on each part of gardening. There's shrubs, trees, vines, houseplants, wildflowers, annuals, perennials, vines,
bulbs,
fruit,
vegetables, fruits,
herbs,
yeah, everything.
You know.
It's great. It's one of those books we often talk about how, you know, the internet's a great resource, but we still really love the tangible experience that books provide.
Mm-hmm.
And every gardener should have a well-stocked reference library.
Yes, and one thing about my book you need to know is it's not a coffee table book.
No.
It doesn't have color pictures. It came out at a time originally when everybody was doing these big glossy color garden books, which were beautiful. I mean, I bought a ton of them, and I love them. But my book doesn't belong on the coffee table.
No.
You take it out to the shed.
Yeah. It's a book to
be
used.
You get it dirty.
Yeah. A book to be used for sure.
It can talk to the asparagus.
Yeah. Barbara, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
We appreciate your time.
It's a pleasure.
Great. Barbara Damrosch and her husband, Elliot Coleman, run Four Season Farm, an experimental four-season market garden in Harborside, Maine. Barbara also writes the weekly column, The Cook's Garden, for the Washington Post, and is the author of The Garden Primer, now celebrating its 20th year and second edition, 100% organic. For more information on Barbara, her farm, and her work, please visit our website at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, another chapter in Bob's Fabulous Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill here.
And we've got some questions.
We do.
The first one's from Mason Cowell. He says that he plans to plant a yew hedge this year, and he's chosen Taxus Media Hicksii.
Mm-hmm.
On a nursery website, they suggest planting these 9 to 12 inches apart for building a formal hedge.
Right.
However, the tag on the 12-inch tall shrubs that I purchased here suggests planting these Hicksii yew 4 feet apart! Exclamation point.
Yeah, right.
Why is there such a big difference in between suggestions for the planting in these yew? What is, quote, unquote, right?
It's only 3 feet.
Yeah.
The only time I could imagine planting them that close together would be if they're already mature and you want to have an instant hedge. Otherwise, 4 feet is about right because they widen out as they go up, and 9 to 12 inches is just nuts.
Yeah, and the Hicksii are real, for those of you who aren't familiar with them, are real columnar.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll grow straight up. And I think that in England, it's more just, it's like a different gardening style.
Right.
Do you think that's fair, Bob?
Yeah.
And also, some people are gardening in smaller spaces as well. I mean, not exclusively by any means. And the hedging tradition in England is much different than that here in the States. So I think that they have a tendency to kind of jam them closer together because they're constantly, I mean, they probably do hedging maintenance 3 times a year or so,
yeah.
At least 2 times a year.
The gardener.
For us here, I think like a 3 to 4 foot distance apart, yeah, is fair. If you want a closer, tightly knit hedge, you can plant them a little closer together. I wouldn't do the 12-inch. I think that's way too close.
No.
But 3 to 4 feet.
And the other problem here is really the bigger problem is it's so hard to plant a 12-inch shrub 4 foot from the next 12-inch shrub. It just looks like it's going to take forever because it is.
Mm-hmm.
And there's almost an aesthetic to that that offends you. You can't, mm-hmm, plant them that far apart.
Right.
Because I want something quicker and
right.
I want it now.
Yeah. And they'll fill out. I mean, Taxus, even this columnar type, they're going to fill out some.
But you're talking 6, 8, 10 years before they bump into each other.
Yeah.
He's got to know that.
Yeah. So if you want to plant them closer together, if you want some instant gratification, but you definitely don't want to do it just 12 inches apart.
I've actually done that and then transplanted them in about 2 or 3 years because they transplant pretty easily.
Yeah. Take out every other one kind of thing.
And just move them, widen the row, or maybe stagger them a little bit.
Uh-huh. So somewhere in between, Mason, lies the truth.
Okay. Now a question for Miss Wishy from Natalie Blanton.
Mm-hmm.
This is right up your dinner plate.
Right up my dinner plate.
Yeah. I was eating a mixed green salad the other day and got to wondering about the baby carrots. In particular, do you know whether these are dwarf variety of some sort, or does somebody just carve up the big carrots and make these cute little carrots?
You know, that's a really funny question.
Yeah, we've talked about this, I think, before.
And
mid-carrot, I think.
And it's like that's one of the reasons why I don't like those baby carrots.
Oh.
Because they're like fake carrots to me, because it's basically somebody that turned a big carrot into a bunch of little carrots.
Well, you got a philosophical problem with baby carrots.
Well, and I like carrots a lot, and I am more than happy to wash a carrot and eat the whole thing. And those baby carrots always seem to get kind of slimy to me. Like, haven't you ever tasted slimy baby carrots? It's gross. But yes, indeed, there are, in fact, dwarf varieties of carrots. The Nantes carrots, it's like a French variety. They're smaller. They're not as small as those baby carrots, but they're small and sort of rounded.
Yeah. I've got the Mickey Rooney carrot, actually.
A little dwarf one. Little carrot top. Right. So there are varieties that are small, but not as small as that. And the ones that you buy at the grocery store are, in fact, little carrots carved out of big, long carrots. Yeah,
Natalie, just keep chomping either way.
That's right. If you like them, you know, enjoy them.
It's your call. If you have a 24-carat question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org, email us at homegrown@WFPL.org, or call us at 814-8246-CARATS.
All right, Bob, it's Plant Story Week. What do you have for us?
First, we're going to test your Latin, Miss Wishy.
All right.
You're going to know this, though, because you're good. Nicotiana alata.
Yeah?
What is it?
Nicotiana is the tobacco plant.
You got it.
And alata, does that mean winged?
You got it.
Okay.
It's the tobacco plant.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Ha-ha. Okay. Sometimes you do actually know what you're talking about, right? Okay.
It's that taking yes for an answer thing, dude.
Okay. All right.
Flowering tobacco, which is a plant I've never been able to grow well. Have you had much luck with it or even tried it?
I have tried it, and it always gets sort of... like leggy.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yep, that's the problem with it.
Yep.
It's the flowering tobacco, a native of Brazil. It's an annual, reseeds. It's a tall, leggy plant, but 1 to 3 feet tall. Flowers stick out like trumpets.
Yeah.
Kind of interesting.
Really long.
Yeah, pink and red and lavender and lime and yellow. It likes fold apart sun, but the foliage isn't very attractive to me. I don't like the foliage, and it's sticky. It's crinkly and it's sticky. It collects dust and collects bugs. It needs lots of water. It looks wilty and droopy during the day. However,
there's got to be something redeeming.
When the sun goes down and the moon comes up,
the
flowers go to work.
It's a very fragrant scent.
At night. It kicks in, and the fabled use is under your bedroom window, wafting through the window before air conditioning, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And it does not smell like tobacco, but we'll get to that in a little bit. It's a member of the Solanacea family, or the deadly nightshade.
Mm-hmm.
That's from the Latin Solomon, meaning quieting or sedative. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that.
Like also tomatoes, potatoes, eggplant.
Mm-hmm. And being deadly nightshade would make sense, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's called Nicotiana because it does have a high concentration of nicotine.
Mm-hmm.
Alata, you're right, wings or flanges. I didn't know this, sir. This is what's interesting. Nicotine was named for the French ambassador to Portugal, Jean Nicot.
Huh. I didn't know that either.
I didn't either. He got the flower seeds from a Dutch sea captain in the middle 1500s.
Mm-hmm.
A little intrigue here. It all led to the plant being used as a plant, and then, of course, later on came a tobacco, which is Nicotiana tobacum.
Mm-hmm.
Tobacco got its name because it came from either Tobago in the West Indies or Tabasco in Mexico.
Uh-huh.
It made its way to the United States, of course, where it became banned in most night spots, including after a while. So it's got a very mixed history as a flower and then as a plant that kills us.
Uh-huh.
So, of course, that comes with, how mixed can you get?
No kidding.
Comes with a poem.
And it's leggy to boot.
Yeah, everything about it except the fragrance, it just isn't worth having. Huh. But then there it is.
Yep.
Poem. How could a flower that smells so sweet and does so well in our Louisville heat be linked so closely to death and deceit? That's what I want to know. How could a flower with such perfume lingering there in the dark bedroom be linked so closely to death and doom? That's what I want to know. How could a flower with so little to show go back 400 years to a man named Nicot? And why have we allowed it to poison us so? That's what I want to know.
Aww. But don't be confused that the Nicotiana elata is not the smoking tobacco.
Don't smoke it.
And it can at least impart some sweet scent in the night air.
Just turn off your air conditioner.
Yeah, no kidding. Save some energy, huh?
That's it.
All right. Sounds good, Bob. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, The Art of Espalier and Trillium. The woodland garden never shined so brightly.
Homegrown is produced by the well-traveled Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.